Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon on this very heated, spicy, and wonderful Sunday. This is Cassandra Dane, and you're on the edge. And today I have a fantastic guest with me. He is actually... And I'm going to tell my guests, don't forget to turn down your computer.
Start a radio show that helps authors reach their dreams.
We have new music. I forgot about that.
Also authors and dedicated to delivering shows to entertain and inspire listeners. The World of Ink Network shares resources that introduce tips, products, and services to help strengthen, support, and challenge those who love writing and the written word. Their hope is to bring not only authors, illustrators, and publishers together, but screenwriters, directors, and producers. New to the network will be a variety of special shows bringing not only entertainment, but informative discussions on timely subjects. To learn more about us, go to www.worldofinknetwork.com or visit us on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thank you for your support and enjoy the show.
Yes, and we actually have the new intro now, which I think is fantastic to kind of give everyone a general idea of what we're doing. And again, you're with Cassandra Dane on the Edge. Today I have an author who is, as Bethany Halley, some of you guys may know that I'm the managing director of both the Edge and Entice Imprints at BookTrope. So I'm lucky enough to have William Prystuck with me today. He's an award-winning screenwriter, a film producer. He's also a teacher, and he even has a summer class coming up, believe it or not. And he's the author of a very edgy book called Bloodletting. Say hello, William. Glad to have you here.
Hello, William. No, hello, Cassandra. Thanks for having me. This is wonderful.
Do you go by William or Bill more?
Bill's fine. Bill's perfect.
Okay. Good. Excellent. And I know you were sitting with us in lovely Pennsylvania, where it's just as hot as it is here in Virginia.
Oh, yeah. Indeed. I just took out the garbage. It's not a pleasant place to be out there, so.
Well, no, heat and garbage don't match, although you could probably do a very scary book on this.
Yeah, maybe. I'll write it down for future use.
Well, tell me a little bit about Bloodletting. Now, I know that the story is basically embroiled in the New York and the underground or the subculture of BDSM community. So why don't you tell me a little bit about it?
Sure. It's about Denny Bowie. He's a 27-year-old, I would say, wannabe private detective. He does have his license, but he works for a firm that works with attorneys. But he's a little off. He's not really the greatest investigator. He loses focus, and he has a chance when his soon-to-be girlfriend calls him and lets him know that there are masochistic murders or murders of masochistic men in Manhattan. Five of men have been killed, including his former best friend, who is a fetish photographer. And he goes, he takes all the money he can out of his account, takes 2 weeks vacation, and he heads back to Greenwich Village in New York City, his old stomping grounds, to hopefully solve what's going on. And it takes him into the whole subculture, back from where he once came, and that's that.
For those of you who may not know what the Edge is in comparison to perhaps a traditional erotic type piece that includes BDSM aspects, the Edge really takes it far out to the extremes, whether it's with certain aspects of the BDSM community or terror, horror, certainly crime dramas, grit, blood, gore, that kind of thing. There's no holes barred other than the basic traditional aspects that you really can't write about. What do you think in this piece makes it so edgy and very different from what you might read typically?
I guess first it has to start with, well, the BDSM element, and I'll talk about that more in a second. But the main character is also bisexual, and one of early on the rejections I was receiving from most publishers was more of letters of regret. They didn't know how to market a bisexual character. So they were like, well, sorry, we can't accept your book, even though we love the writing, which was nice. the BDSM actually didn't bother them. It just bothered them. Gee, how do we market the young guy who's bi, you know? I think what also makes it edgy is one of the things that bothers me about fiction normally in regard to BDSM, and I'm not talking about from people who are involved in the BDSM community or the fetish world or anything like that, but people who are not, do not do their research, and they rely on stereotypes and caricatures of that environment to sell their books, and they are 99 times out of 100 completely wrong. So being from that world myself and being immersed in it, and I wrote about all the places I knew in New York City. Yeah, some are made up, but it's all based on real-life experiences. So I think what makes it edgy is actually the realism, the realistic element to it in regards to making a clear distinction between safe, sane, and consensual BDSM and sadistic crime. And letting people know, like, hey, here's the difference. It's not, it doesn't matter what the DSM says or how people perceive it. It is a, there are different worlds. And I just wanted to make sure that that was clear and the sex is real. And that's pretty much it.
Well, when you say you've been a part of it, does that mean, and I'm putting you a little bit here on the spot, but does that mean you've actually been involved? You know me. You know me well enough by now, Bill, to know I don't hold anything back. That's just
no,
me.
No, I don't want you to. Go ahead.
Now, have you been involved actually in the culture itself as a lifestyle?
Absolutely. Since, I would say, my early college day years, I was with, I don't know if I can mention the group's names or not. One still exists. They're famous. The Eulenspiegel Society. Back in the early 90s, I'd say around 90, 91, when I lived right outside of New York City, I would go there. I think our meetings were every Tuesday evening. And when I moved to out of New Jersey and into eastern Pennsylvania, there was a group, they're now defunct, which is sad because everybody was really wonderful, called Behind the Scenes outside of Philadelphia. Went to several of their parties, and I just reconnected with a group up here in Allentown. And I'll be going to my first play party soon, and I've also been to One Munch, which was really, really wonderful. Great people, great. I think that's the thing, you know, people like, you know, who are these perverted, you know, folks? And, well, I've met so far two people, one person earning a doctorate in psychology, another person has their degree in psychology. I've met a custom agent, U.S. customs agent, what else? Let's see, teachers, a daycare instructor. I mean, the list goes on of, like, your average, everyday people, whether, you know, some are blue-collar, some are white-collar. And, you know, it doesn't matter. It's just regular people. They just have a different inclination beyond, you know, what people consider to be normal sexual activity.
Yeah, and I think for me as an author and someone who's done quite a bit of investigation and you know, some personal experiences with the lifestyle, it really infuriates me that there are so many stereotypes that people have no clue about. And instead of investigating or asking even the basic questions, they assume and they condemn. And that, quite frankly, and happy to say it, pisses me off.
No, me too. I get quite angry. I mean, I'm from New Jersey. We're born angry anyway. But maybe that's not necessarily true. But anyway, no, I feel the same way. I remember. I mean, I don't know if we want to bring up any book titles here or not, but a recent book that's led to several movies and all this stuff gets it so damn wrong. I'm just livid by it, and
you can mention 50 Shades. Sad. You've done it many a time.
Yeah, right. It's deplorable. First of all, it's horrifically written. There's absolutely no editor involved. I wouldn't trust E.L. James to write a grocery list. Every time I have it when I teach, and my students come up to me and they're complaining about their grades or crying about their grades, I always tell them, look, I'm telling you right now, in all honesty, you write better than E.L. James, you know, and that helps. You know, they're so glad.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just that's a book about abuse. That's not BDSM. That's not a safe, sane, and consensual atmosphere. It's not positive. It paints a bad picture. And, you know, and this just fuels people, you know, not only people's, it just adds to their misconceptions, but also in the psychological community, because I know a lot of people in the fetish community have been trying what gay people had done way back in the day, is trying to convince the powers that be to change, you know, the DSM books and let them know, like, you know, this isn't, you know, being safe, sane, and consensual, BDSM shouldn't be thrown in as a medical condition, as a mental condition, with,
right,
you know, some of the other more horrendous things out there. And this is just me making other people think, yeah, you know, it's yeah, it is abuse. And it's like, you read a bad book that I couldn't even get past two pages. You know, you read a bad book and you're making an assumption, and that's just so wrong.
It is.
Unfortunately, that's how our society works.
It is. I'm dealing with something personally right now that has potentially could affect a new job, and it draws you back to, even though Americans claim to be of the land of the free and the brave and all of this, they're really a cloistered and very cluster-based society that are fearful of what they don't know.
This is true, but, you know, I'm on the one hand, I'm thankful for being the way I am, because I learned early on from going to New York City. I lived in Kearny. It's right outside of New York City, and I would just hop on the PATH train, and, you know, in a short while, you're right in Washington Square Park. And from realizing early on, when I finally figured out what, you know, BDSM was, because I didn't have a definition, I thought I was just sick, twisted, and demented. I didn't know it had, like, a name, and that there are other people into this stuff as I was, as a young person. Because I pretty much knew where I was at age six with this stuff. And it was funny, because in those early years, I wanted to be labeled. I wanted labels because I needed to know where I belonged.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I grew up, and I traveled to New York City more and saw all sorts of different people and realized it doesn't matter where we come from, who we are, what we do, gay, straight, whatever. Everybody's the same, because everybody's concerned about their job, finances, love, you know, all the basic things. You know, so that was great. So it helps me when people bring up something that I'm unfamiliar with or that just sounds really off the wall. It allows me to check myself. So I just keep my ears open and become an active listener. And hear what they have to say. And I think this has totally helped me as a teacher, because students quite often tell me I'm not judgmental at all. And they know, and they every student should feel safe with an instructor that they could to say anything that they want to and not be, you know, scorned or anything else.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Mm-hmm. I think that the importance of letting our children know to help them, guide them as they're growing up, that there are differences in people and there's a variety of us, and that's what makes all of us very special, is very important. And, of course, as authors, just trying to pin, or at least I feel this way, and I'm curious if you do, pinning certain stories and trying to get the details as correct as possible, it's almost like, it's not a burden, I wouldn't call it, but I think it's a responsibility, at least I innately feel, to try and get it right.
Have I mentioned lately that I love you? No, I'm
serious.
Well, you
know me.
You,
I mean, you've been around the block with me enough to know that it is very
mm-hmm.
important to me. And that's one of the reasons that I like doing the shows and providing, you know, authors another chance to speak to it, because I think it's vital.
I agree. And to answer your question, and yes, I completely agree with you, you used the perfect words, you know, writer's responsibility. In fact, I wrote a blog on that writers have a responsibility because of the utterly irresponsible E.L. James work. And, oh, I don't even want to say work to me, whatever. Anyway, I did so much research for Bloodletting. I spoke to New York homicide detective, police officer. I needed to know information about reservoirs, so what did I do? I contacted the person who knew everything about reservoirs, a water department supervisor. I have a nun in the book. What about nuns? I went to a nun. You know, I Google Maps. I looked at other maps. I researched ad nauseum on the internet and in books. I went to libraries. I did so much work that my one colleague said, "Bill, you did more for your MFA," because this was originally an MFA project when I earned my terminal degree. "You did more for that than I did for my entire dissertation." And that's because I want everything to be as accurate as possible. I want to portray, you know, police procedure. How does it work with morgues and everything else? I had been in the police academy for a while, but I didn't finish because of an injury, which is actually fine. But, you know, I want to make sure that I get it right. I don't want anyone to go, "Oh, that can't happen." I want to make sure that I nailed it, because it's my responsibility as a writer to make sure that no one feels slighted or that they're being dumped upon or anything like that. I wanted it to be realistic as possible. So, and it's fun to do because you learn so much, and it only adds flavor and character to your writing.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I think that's such an important aspect for the readers also to know, because even if they might not know about homicide detectives, they're going to know if you get it wrong, because whether it's television shows or not, which, you know, are a different depiction sometimes, but I think they can feel it in your writing. If you're unsure, it comes across.
Oh, yeah, agreed. Agreed. I could usually tell right away when people didn't do their research, because I'm a lifelong learner. I originally have a degree in history, and I love English, and I love asking people questions and just learning about who they are, where they've come from. I like to learn something new every day. I mean, and that's great. Sometimes I write little notes for my writing in the future, but, you know, writers have to be diligent. We do have a responsibility. I had someone, they wrote a character who's a police officer, and I even told him, I said, "Your writing is fantastic, but this is the worst police officer ever, because the person didn't investigate police work. What they did was they relied on the TV shows and stuff that they had seen," and it's like, Hollywood reality is not reality, and it just didn't work. It was laughable, and he knew it, which was fine. So, because writing is a process, and as long as you get people early in to take a look at everything and to make sure that you're being vigilant, then life's good. So, luckily we caught it early.
That's very true. We're going to do a slight station identification. Just for everyone who's listening, you're on The Edge with Cassandra Dane, and this is the World of Ink Network. We'd love to have you guys call in, talk to Bill, ask him any crazy, wild, wonderful questions. And the call-in number is 714-242-5259. Now, I'm curious, since you have done the level of investigation and everything into the two basic sides, the BDSM side, the gritty police detective, and the crimes that happen in between. Have you had any comments about, from whether it's critics, reviewers, readers, et cetera, that they could tell how easily or that you were separating the difference in abusive physical activity versus BDSM in the regard of the book?
Thankfully, yes, and that's been wonderful. Many reviewers... one who was familiar with the lifestyle said that I showed a great amount of respect for the environment, and then I caught it in an honest fashion. And several other people said it was great. They loved the mystery, they loved the story, they loved how it went, but they also loved what they learned and how they really understand what BDSM is now. And I felt it was great, because they weren't complaining that I was hitting them over the head or anything like that. That it isn't an educational guide. It was like, it's a great mystery, and I learned a lot about, you know, how this, you know, lifestyle is, so I get it now. And that just felt so, I felt like I really accomplished something, and so I'm really happy about that.
It is gratifying. I think that for me, having, and I on my blog, and I want to ask you about some of your blogs too. On my blog, I try and, I guess in a sense, educate from some personal points of view about the more of the DS lifestyle. And it's gratifying to me when people actually ask questions or say, "I'm no longer fearful," or "I'm going to talk to my husband," or, you know, whatever the case may be. Have you had that a bit with your blogs as well?
Well, my blog's really a horror blog, but I have people who will message me separately in regard to the book and talk about some of what they're interested in. And usually it's people who haven't, you know, gone beyond their own internal fantasies because they don't know how to approach people. They don't know how, like, you know, they've learned through media and fiction, fictional works, whether books or films, to be wary of, you know, S&M groups and organizations and whatnot. And so it's great. They feel comfortable to discuss it. And, you know, I give them a little bit of information that, you know, they could use to continue their research to hopefully get out there a little bit and just not be fearful. Let's see if they can, you know, find somebody that they can connect with. And because this is about, it's almost like BDSM, you know, to a degree. You know, yeah, there's light and heavy and all this other stuff, but it's adult games. And so why not find an adult play partner and have a good time and not be fearful? There's a stigma attached to it, and that's what I think freaks people out so much. I've reached a point where I sort of really don't care.
Yes, and that's good. I think that again also helps come across in your writing. You're vivid with it. You're, you know, kind of avant-garde in how you approach things, and that's very important. And I do think that it really shows in a beautiful graphic fashion.
Oh, thank you so much, Cassandra. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Now, being that you are doing many other things, including screenwriting, and as you mentioned, you also touch quite a bit on horror. Tell me some more about other things you're doing.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I love thrillers. I love that thrill. I love the element of suspense, which can grow out of any conflict. So what I normally do is I like to write screenplays first, because to me they serve as a glorified outline for a novel. And what I normally do when I'm finished with the screenplay, I send it out to contests, see if I can, you know, gain recognition. And if they do really, really well and the feedback's fine, then that's like, well, this is great, because then I can take this script and turn it into a book. And because Hollywood doesn't buy anything anymore. But
yeah.
I'm working on a script called Red Agenda, which is about an older detective. He works, it's an alternate universe thing, because it's paranormal horror, crime thriller. And he's the lead for Philadelphia's paranormal crimes unit. And he has to stop a group of, in the first story, at least, it's a group of terrorist vampires called Red Agenda. He has to stop them from killing the president. He only has 3 days. He doesn't know where they are. He doesn't know how they're going to get to the president. And he has few clues. You know, one of those things, backs up against the wall. And can he trust his informant? And can he, you know, his team's on the brink. And, you know, everything's stacked against him. And can he win the day, type of thing. I'm working on revising that right now. Oh, thanks. It's a lot of fun. I love that. I love the character, and it's great to create an alternate world once in a while.
Oh, yeah. Would you like to take those and see them actually on the movie screen?
I would. Red Agenda, when that won at the International Horror and Sci-Fi Film Festival in Arizona, the feedback was immense. 13 different production companies were interested in it, which is fantastic. A gentleman even called me while I was at school from Sundance, because he said, I keep hearing about your script up here, and it's like, I have to have it. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is fantastic. It's great, you know. Two problems. I had a really, really bad agent, and then the economy collapsed. And as soon as the economy collapsed, every production company backed off buying anything new.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't work. The good news is now, with Bloodletting, for instance, because of the book and because of it's been well received so far, there are two production companies that have contacted me about the original script, and they're looking at that now. So, you know, only time will tell. But I would love to. I think they'd be great on the screen. I mean, both of them were written for that originally. So I'd love to see that. I'd like to make them myself, but I need a lot of money to do that.
Yeah.
Like multi-millions of dollars, you know.
Well, I think some of them, too, are better suited, you know, to the screen in the sense that there are lower-budget films, but if you're creating an alternate world, I'm sure it has a little bit more special effects.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and bloodletting, you could keep that on the cheap. You really could. But there are a lot of different locations, so that means travel time and everything else. And because I do make films as well, and it's great to see, like, you really learn. I learned early on from my mom how to budget my life. She told me at 13, son, we think you're smart enough to go to college, but we're not going to pay for it because we didn't pay for your sisters. They were 12 years older than me, and I said, okay. So at 13, you know, I started working at a local restaurant, and I really learned how to make a dollar go. And the same thing with movie making. It's like, okay, we have $10. What can we, what can we do with this? And how can we do it and make it look like it's quality? How can we get quality people involved when we don't have, when the only thing we could offer is a really nice meal break, you know? Bloodletting is within my grasp to make that a movie on my own. Red Agenda, that would, oof, that's big money I wouldn't have.
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't know what will happen in the future. As you've said, the economy is perking up a bit, and there is a hunger for something new, very creative. And I know from what I've heard in the industry that producers are looking for the raw and the edgy, and that's why some of the edgier pieces are really hitting home and making, you know, bestsellers, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great, because that's what, you know, one of the things that I wanted to do with bloodletting was I used to give, when I read a book, 50 pages, then 25, and now I only give two paragraphs. And that two paragraphs, I can tell if the person can write well or not, and that's the most important thing to me. If they write well, I don't care what the genre is, subject matter, adult, you know, YA, I don't care what it is, I will read it. But I always hate the authors who, like, use purple prose, or they try to keep a distance from this horrible subject matter. Like, I always hate mysteries when they start, well, there's the body on the ground, it's got a knife in the back, and like, that's it. You know, and it's like a Miss Marple or a Sherlock Holmes kind of thing. Somebody has a knife in their back, they're not looking good. You know, it's like, it's a real ugly mess. There's blood everywhere. There's going to be blood on the ceiling. Just, you know, it's just awful. Blood will pool. They'll look horrible, and it won't be like, oh, that's Fred. Gee, what happened to Fred? No, it can't be like that. I want it to be gritty. I want it to be real. I want my five senses to be engaged in it. So that's why that's how I approached bloodletting, and I hope people, you know, enjoy that.
I love writing thrillers. That's probably what I'm turning toward more now than, quite frankly, I get, I hate to say it, world, but I'm bored to death with erotic romance. It's just, you know, it's flipping been done to death, Cassandra included. So, you know, I'm moving on. You know, and now I kill people in my erotic books, and that just takes it to a whole other level.
Oh, sure.
You know.
Absolutely.
I think people are looking for something different.
Yeah, this is why the one thing about movie making is great, because you could have a multi-genre film and they love it, because the way producers and all look at it is the more genres you have, the more people will be sitting in the audience. And with books, it's different. It's like, well, you're saying that this is a hard-boiled crime thriller with BDSM elements. Well, you know, some people try to shoehorn it right away into being erotica, and it's like, whoa, this isn't an erotic novel. You know, this isn't like, you know, sex scene. Yeah, it's just not, that's not how it is. It's a mystery first. It has these elements, and why can't it have those elements? You know, why can't I have a bisexual character? Why can't I have, well, he's not an older seasoned detective. Well, why can't I have a younger guy with little experience who's also, you know, who loves punk rock music more than anything else? Why can't I have that? And so I just wanted to do something different. I didn't want the same formula. You know, being a horror movie fan, you can imagine I deal with formula like every day, and I hate it. You know, I look for those new independent films that take chances. Even if they're not perfect, I will appreciate them far more than a well-made, you know, Hollywood big studio-based movie that follows A plus B equals C. I want those different alternative items in my entertainment.
And if you look at what's happening in the marketplace, you can see that the mm-hmm. desire or the hunger is there, whether it's these reality shows that are getting more and more out there, you know, for the lack of a better phrase,
yeah.
on the edge. You know, you kind of wonder, how far are we going? You know, is it going to be, you know, are we going to have the Running Man that's going to be a reality and, you know, people are then wanting to see more blood, more gore? I honestly think that we'll see that at some point in our lifetime.
Yeah, like anything else, it's funny with this, you know, whether it was the crime story I wrote, you know, with bloodletting or the horror book that I'm writing now, everything has to have a purpose to me. If I'm going to have a gory scene, it can't be gratuitous. It has to have value. It has to be able to teach the reader something new, give us a clue to the story, reveal character. If those elements aren't there and it's just for blood's sake or gore's sake, then no. I could have gone way over the top with gore and everything else, even in bloodletting, and I'm like, no, there's no need. There were a couple occasions where I had to, but they were all vital to the story. Otherwise, it had to get cut from the narrative because it would just weaken the narrative. So I think there's a place for everything as long as it could, you know, be justified. I remember someone saying, you know, Fight Club was too violent. I'm like, it's called Fight Club. It's about Fight Club. Didn't you get that going into the theater? What's wrong with you? Why did you even buy a ticket? And that's mm-hmm. the thinking I can't. It's like, Just stay home. Just stay home. And do me a favor. Try and read a book, good book for once, and maybe that'll change your mind. But, yeah, you can't. I mean, if the subject warrants what's happening, then that's fine. So.
Well, it's interesting about reviewers, and I think that brings us to a good point. I think in writing mm-hmm. something that is a little bit different than the norm, it's not the formula-based. You know, you have to have sex by page
right.
two. You have to have, you know, blah, happy ever after ending. They fly off into the sunset on their, you know, white steed, which bores the hell out of me. You know, gag me
yeah.
with these, and no pun to book trope, but it's called a trope piece when you have a specific
yeah, exactly.
guideline. And there are a lot of writers out there that are making millions on these romance trope pieces. I can't
sure.
do it.
No.
It bores me. But yeah. I think that reviewers are used to reading a certain type of work, whether it be from an author that they've read before or just a basic genre. And when they're hit with something between the eyes, I've found that a lot give a very poor review, basically because they didn't like the concept of the material, not the material itself. Have you found that with bloodletting?
So far, no. I'm glad even the reviews that weren't necessarily five star, and I want honest reviews from people. It's like they I think either appreciated what I tried to do or something, like, you know, some people like, I didn't like how this mixed or whatever. And that's fine. I mean, there's nothing I can do about that. But for the most part, though, some people said it was refreshing to see BDSM sex that is different from the norm, because it isn't just about spankings or whipping. Like, I wanted to add, if I'm talking about a taboo subject, BDSM, then why not give him a taboo fetish? And he enjoys watching women smoke and all, and that's his part of his fetish. So I included that, and, you know, people like that. You know, because, again, it was different. It showed them a different side between, like you said, the tropes. You know, break out the, okay, she's got to wear a bustier and, you know, long gloves and have a whip or a cane. And, you know, no, it's more than that. I wanted to do something different. And so far, that's been appreciated by most people, and I'm really thrilled about that. So
that's good. I think that adds credibility to the heightened level of a thriller with elements of BDSM in it. And I think that you're going to begin, hopefully, and I say this hopefully because I'm not sure how movie production houses are going to see it, film it, want to bring it to the masses because, you know, think of all the hysteria almost about PG-13 or, oh, my God, if it's rated R for 50 Shades.
Well, I'm not necessarily looking for Hollywood. I'm looking for, you know, the people who are looking at it now are, you know, two independent studios, which is, you know, definitely what you want for this. And the screenplay I have, there's actually a link to the screenplay near the back of the book. The screenplay is R-rated. I went a little beyond that in the novel because I could. Obviously, for film in this country, because we're so puritanical, you know, you can't. I'm sure if it was a European-based production, they could definitely do much more than in the very conservative filmmaking in the United States. So so I have an R-rated script, and, you know, I'd say it's probably an unrated, you know, novel. But, yeah, they could definitely film, you know, bloodletting, and it would be, you know, okay for an 18-plus audience.
It will be interesting to see how the movie industry changes, or the book industry for that matter, because it is constantly evolving. As with anything with the publishing world, you see trends in books. After 50 Shades, there were 5 million people that on day two wrote a S&M novel, and they had no clue what they were writing.
Exactly.
Some of them got famous. You know, next it'll be, right, I think it's Westerns or Cowboys right now, or Hot, and Romance I'm talking. You know, and it's going to be something
else. Yeah, spin the roulette wheel, and someone else will get their 15 minutes, and then we'll move on from there. The thing to me is, again, you know, regardless of genre, did you write something that's compelling, that's unique enough where I'll want to... And not only engage in and indulge in it, but tell other people about it. And, you know, that's what I want. I don't care what it is, as long as it's not something I've engaged before, because that's just going to bore the hell out of me. I want something new every time.
And I kind of wrote a piece for Bethany's blog yesterday commenting on writing in several genres. And I think a lot of authors write in one genre because their readers expect that of them and are, again, kind of fearful.
Right. Agreed.
And for me personally,
you know,
as an author, I'm bored.
Well, I from what I've read, and I hate it because it's funny, I could write any type of movie I want. I'm working on a science fiction film, movie as well. And I'm working on, what else did I wrote a comedy, you know, but, okay, you wrote this, you know, crime thriller, so you have to stick with crime or thrillers or both for at least 2 years before you bust out of your, you know, little genre niche. And it's like, oh, come on. You know, but that's how, you know, well, at least that's what I've been told. And that's how, you know, publishing is a different animal, but it is changing every day, just as filming, just anything in the arts. It's funny because on the one hand, I think we're in a cultural dark ages because of so much crap out there. But on the other hand, because people can, and maybe they shouldn't pick up a camera and run out and make a film or whatever, because people think that, you know, they don't take the time to study craft. They don't take the time to read. And, you know, it's like, well, so-and-so did it. Well, I could do it too. And that's not necessarily the right way to think. But the people who are just picking up stuff and running out there, and trying to make something happen. You know, there is some cream to that crop, and hopefully that will continue to rise, and a lot of this ugly stuff will fall away, and only the, you know, the really wonderful stuff will remain that, you know, can maybe fit in many different, you know, facets and varieties without having to be pigeonholed like so many other things seem to.
I realize I think it's also a double-edged sword, whether it is independent filmmakers that, you know, have $5,000, a pretty good camera, and they think they're a filmmaker, or it's an author who goes out and self-publishes because either no one else will accept them or they figured they could grasp all the money to themselves.
Right.
There's a lot of crap out there. However, I do think it has allowed the opportunity for people to read and explore different things. The imaginations are kind of heightened on different levels. I know some folks are followers, and you have a lot of the same slasher-type flicks or the same erotic-type books. But it has opened up the worlds, I think, for all of us a little bit more than certainly it was, you know, 5 or 6 years ago.
Oh, agreed. And I think a lot of people, like when I did bloodletting, I wanted to make sure that I wasn't like, hey, this is my book. You know, it's great. Publish it. Thanks. I'm not going to listen to the editor. I wanted to listen to my editor, even if it was painful. And I was at a panel. My wife, Allie Bishop, was on an editing panel, and the one editor said, editing should be painful. And I loved it because it's true. And because the editor is detached from the story. They embrace the story, not the person, and they want that story to resonate with readers. So when I first started working with my editor, Gerald Broad, he was really wonderful because he picked out all my writing weaknesses, and every writer has weaknesses, and as a writer, you must know what they are. So as soon as I saw his first editing, I'm like, oh my God, you know, this is the guy, you know, because it's, you know, he knows what I'm doing wrong. Even though I swear to God, I tried like hell to fix it. And every time he caught something, I was like, ah, son of a bitch, because I thought I got that. But in the end, with the notes and the cutting and the cutting and the more cutting, you know, I came out with a much better, tighter, fast-moving story. And the reviews reflect that. And I think anyone who's in, trying to be artistic and spearheading something, like with a book, you have to look at your team. And your teammate, your number one teammate, is your editor. You know, you can't just go, oh, they don't know what you're talking about. No, they do know what they're talking about. Maybe you don't. So listen to them. Same thing with film. When I have a short film coming out, and the editor put on, you know, a film by William Dupre stock on it, and I'm like, no, this was a collaborative effort. My ego's in check. Take that off of there. I'm the director and the producer. That's fine, but it's not like my vision or anything like that. Everybody, I would take ideas from anyone. Hey, Bill, why don't we shoot this scene that way? You know what? That's a good idea. Let's do this. This doesn't work. What else can we do? Anybody have an idea? Hey, that's a great idea. Let's do that. It's a collaborative effort, and you need to listen to people around you. Maybe not necessarily, you know, people who know what they're talking about, so we can make your art better. And when it works, it works.
And I think that's an interesting bridge to the fact that you brought your piece to Book Trope, which is based on a team and collaborative effort. And I know you and I have talked about some difficulties with keeping a book manager. And for those listening, Book Trope is based on a team. You have your author, you have an editor, proofreader, cover designer, and book managers are there to help with the marketing aspect. With an imprint line such as what Bill is in and I'm in as the writers that I am, you also have a director that tries to look and guide and help and find different marketing avenues. And it's very time-consuming for everyone, I think. And finding the right team fit can be daunting at times. I know you've experienced that.
Yes, I did. But I was blessed early on to find Gerald and also Liam Amore, who did the cover photography because I didn't want art, and eventually ended up with a wonderful proofreader in Patricia Eddy, who's amazing. So, yeah, it took time, but it was important because I had three publishers who were interested in the novel, ultimately, and I had to make a decision. And, you know, my research quickly showed that the one publisher was being sued by all their writers. Not a good sign at all.
No.
The other one, the contract was so bizarre, I didn't need a lawyer to tell me, don't even. I saved it because people can't even tell you why it was so bizarre. It was just so mind-boggling, crazy. And Bookchoke had an excellent contract. And, again, it's like anything else. It's like, you know, you have to make the best of it. You know, Bookchoke allows the author to pick a team. I think I've done pretty good so far. And, you know, made sure that I had people who knew something, who had more, you know, better skills than I did, knew more than I did. And they made sure that I listened to them, and I saw their work, and I appreciated it, and I respected it. And it's like anything else. You know, when I make a movie, we cast people. Okay, 50 people show up to play the lead role. We have to pick one out of the 50. And it comes down to the person with the best skills, the best professional attitude, and, you know, all these other things. And that's the same approach I took with Booktrope. And so far it's worked. I think the reviews are really solid, so I think that's proof right there that, you know, I did the right thing. Because every author should be, anybody in the arts, you know, they want validation. They want, and I know it should be internal, but still, I want to make sure that, you know, I say, man, as a teacher and everything else, most of the writing out there is crap. Well, how good is my writing? You know, really, can I look at it objectively? I'm reading books on craft. I've been reading forever. I've been working at this since I was 6 years old. You know, and I want to make sure that I have the right people to help me so I don't look like a fool when I send stuff out. You know, mm-hmm. Yeah, Bill, you know, you need to make this change. If you don't, my God, it's going to sink your whole ship here. Or, yeah, that's great. Really, it's good. It's good enough to go, man. Let it go. You know, and too many people get caught up with ego and like, oh, no, I know what I'm doing. I've even seen people with that in writing programs. Oh, no one can critique my poetry, one person said. You're in a writing program, a professional writing program that earned a terminal degree, and no one can, like, how old are you, 10? If you can't take criticism, don't write, get out. You know, you can't be bizarre like that.
It is interesting. It's like anything else, though. Any profession, you're going to find egos, of course. But it seems to be very concentrated in the writing, film, music, I'm certain, you know, those kind of industries, because you need, in a sense, a certain level of ego to market, to push, and to keep trying.
Sure.
And sometimes you're doing it on a shoestring budget, or you're not getting money for your book, or, you know, whatever the case may be. So it can be tough.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And plus, when you do something artistic, it's always an extension of yourself in some way, shape, or form. You could write the most bizarre, off-the-wall science fiction, but there are chunks of your soul in that thing. And, you know, people are very, you know, protective of that. So, no, I understand, but trust your editors. That's, you know, or
true.
And don't think, yeah, I could publish this. I don't need an editor. Yes, you need an editor. I'm telling you right now you do. So...
Oh, nothing follows you faster than a bad edit for a very, very long time.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. It's better to patient than...
And, you know, kind of a story for if any of our authors or other authors or wannabe authors are out there, it doesn't matter how many times often that you've had, let's say, an edit. I've had the experiences of having books edited a couple of times, and someone else will do it years later, and they'll find something completely different. Sometimes it's viewpoint.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a fresh set of eyes, and sometimes it's a fresh set, a person that's new to you as an author, not someone who, quote, knows your writing style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's why... Any author, you know, needs to be patient. Yeah, I know you want your book out there and all. I waited a long time to get this book out there. The story is, my gosh, I wrote this screenplay in, what was it, 98? And it was from a story I had back when I was an undergrad in college. So this story is, like, actually technically, like, 30 years old.
Wow.
I'm not kidding. And, yeah, you know, and it just, it was just deplorable in the beginning, but... You know, what it became and what it grew into was great. I took my time, and I'm glad I did. You know, and I could definitely edit it again, I'm sure. But I can't look at it anymore. I'm done. You know, it's just
right.
Like, we're all at time. But take your time. I mean, there was one person who calls themselves, she calls herself a writer. She finished her book in the morning, and then she published it in the evening on Amazon. And it's like, what are you doing? How could you do that? I've read Bloodletting 15, 20 times. No, more than that. At least 24 times. I edited on my own 10 times. I've had one editor, one mentor, I've had feedback from a fiction editor from a small press, a well-respected, award-winning small press. I've taken all of that into account. I've had other professional people look at it, and I took comments. Doesn't mean I changed my story. It means I tightened it and I made it better. And you need to take the time to do that. There's just too much stuff. I just had somebody, he just asked me, Bill, can you review my book? First paragraph, 5 lines. No, it was three sentences. He used 2 men are talking. He used the word man 5 times. He didn't introduce them. I couldn't tell who was who. Misspelled word. I'm like, sorry, I can't read your, I can't review it. He was a nice person, but it's like, how can you have a misspelling? Mm-hmm. One person yesterday I met online, said, you know, he wanted me to follow him on LinkedIn, and he said, I'm an author. A-U-T-H-R-O-R. He spelled author wrong.
Oh.
I'm like, come on. No, I can't follow you. I can't be linked into you. That's impossible. I'm like, come on. I've actually had 2 students misspell their own names. So I know this stuff can happen, but you have to take the time and proofread. And it doesn't mean I don't make mistakes. Of course I make mistakes. But, man, I work hard. If I make a mistake, it's, I don't know what happened, but, I work hard to make sure that, you know, I put out the best possible, in the end, you know, I hate to say it like this, but product, you know, that could be put out there so people will enjoy it.
Yes, and I think that's a valid point that I've tried to tell, especially it's good for any author. I don't care if you've been writing for 30 years or 2 years. Put your best foot and your best work forward. Don't write it, leave it alone, and expect your editor to catch everything wrong.
No. No, you can't. You can't. And it definitely, one of the things that I did near the end, and I always, if I tell my students to do something, I have to do it because I don't want to be a hypocrite and a liar. I read my book aloud. And at the time I read it aloud, it was 94,000 words. It's since been cut down to 80. And I read it aloud, word by word, and I wouldn't believe the things that you catch when you read aloud. And I even called a plot hole. And I was like, oh, my God. man, it's better to catch it than to not and to look, you know. I mean, that plot hole was really bad. It was amazing because so many people had missed it, including me, over all those times. The role was, a few years of the making at that point, and Just take your time. Take your time. It's not a race. And if you think you're going to make millions, you're delusional. You know, unless you have something absolutely brilliant. You know,
lightning can strike, but it's not going to strike very often.
Exactly.
I have a book here.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, go ahead. It's your show.
No, I highlight the authors. It's not my show, per se. So go ahead. What were you going to say?
All right, then real quick. Did you ever hear of Ellen Miller before?
No.
No, of course you didn't. No one did. I read a short story of hers in a book on, I believe it was Brooklyn Noir. I loved it. It was the best thing in the book. Just phenomenal writing. I found out she had one novel. I bought it, read the book. Totally in love with it. It was a dramatic book about people in drug culture. I hate the drug culture. I'm not, and I hate it because I'm not into it. But my God, the book is absolutely brilliant. I got involved with the characters. Everything was just fantastic. My wife read it. It's one of the few times we agreed on something artistically. She loves it as well. And the thing is, it's brilliant. Few people know about it. The poor author, this is her only book because she passed on. Soon afterwards, she died of a heart attack. I think she was teaching at the New School in New York City. And it's such a loss. And the thing is, there's so much stuff out there. Half a million books are published each year in the United States, indie publishers and everything else. and, you know, something amazing like this got lost in the shuffle. This is the thing that should be, you know, on some sort of a pedestal. This is the thing that a movie should be made about. This is the person who should be receiving the accolades, but does not,
right.
Because there's so much stuff that's flooded in there. You know, just because something's popular doesn't mean it's great. So, you know, with your Transformers movies, you know, it doesn't matter how many people are running out to see that. You know, just take the time, too, as a reader to, you know, look at new things from new people. Sorry,
that's
true. Now you can go.
You know, and I think that highlighting other authors at times is very valuable. It's important. And I think that the authors who take that time to showcase and share and all of it on whatever social media site or just word of mouth with their friends, I think that's fantastic and what should be done.
Exactly. That's why I like Goodreads, you know, because you get, you know, tips from people all the time. I think that's a great site. You know, some wonder people, hey, Bill, have you seen this book yet? And, you know, quite often, yeah, thanks, man. That suggestion was amazing. Just because there's so much stuff out there. Like, students come up to me all the time, Bill, have you read? And I go, no. And I'm like, I didn't even finish my sentence. And I'm like, because I didn't read it, because there's a gazillion books out there. But you have to tell me if it's really worth it or not. And then you go from there.
Absolutely. Well, we are actually, believe it or not, running down on time. So I want to make sure that folks, I know, can you believe it? An hour goes by fast in my world.
Well, you are a doll, that's why. It's just, I'm lost in you, so.
Yeah. All right, now. Remember, I know how to find you.
Oh, I know you don't.
Tell us how we can indeed find you, blogs, websites, et cetera, all those groovy, sexy places that you have your fantastic books.
Oh, okay. Well, the book is available through Amazon, of course, and Barnes & Noble. There are, if you get the book between the acknowledgments and the epilogue, there is a code that you can go to my website, crashpalaceproductions.com, go to the link books, and then you'll have access to deleted chapters, as well as a song playlist and the original screenplay. And you could follow me at Crash Palace. That's always the best on Twitter, which is always the best way to get in touch with me. So I would recommend both of those.
Fantastic.
And, thank you. And I have a podcast on horror, if you like horror films, called The Last Knock, which is available through iTunes or, again, through crashpalaceproductions.com.
That's interesting, the podcast. Is that something, are you interviewing folks, or are you just talking about the horror genre industry?
I interview as well as I have a co-host. My co-host is Johnny Numb, and he also has a literary background as well. So we try to take a more substantial look at horror cinema besides like, oh, yeah, that chainsaw scene was awesome. We try to look at the thematic value and all the other elements that make up great genre writing. And we've been on 2 years now. We have listeners in 150 countries around the world, won an award last year. So we're really happy. It continues to grow.
Well, that's fantastic. I will have to look that up, actually. This time is the first that I've heard about your podcast, so I'm actually very, very interested in that. So you'll have to share with me.
Yes, I will, ma'am.
If you would have one piece of advice for authors, whether longtime authors or aspiring, what would it be?
Again, get an editor. You have to get an editor. You have to have somebody look at it. You have to be critiqued. Is it tough? Sometimes, yeah. And, you know, some people don't know. I know. This, the biggest thing for me every day is my writing good enough? Because I have even students, Bill, this is the greatest thing you're going to read. And it's like, oh, my God, like, dude, no, it's not. You know, be honest with yourself. You have to be honest with yourself. Get an editor, always. And pay attention, listen, and take your time. Don't have an emotional knee-jerk response to it. It's tough. Believe me, I did at times. It's tough. But in the end, in the end you have something that more people are going to really love, because all you need to do is go on Amazon and Goodreads and see the books that were put into the marketplace prematurely, and I've seen authors go, yeah, I blew it. I released that book 3 months too early. I needed an editor. And mm-hmm. don't make that mistake. Take your time. Take your time.
That is a very vital thoughts, and I appreciate that, and I know all of our readers and listeners do. Thank you so much for being here. It's been wonderful getting to know you more.
And you are fabulous. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm beyond grateful. I'm truly appreciative, dear.
You are very, very welcome. And we will be chatting more about all the good things coming up, and I do hope you're going to bring more to the edge.
Oh, I hope so, too. Thank you.
I'm going to hold you to it.
Okay.
All right, Bill. Thank you so much, and have a fantastic afternoon.
Well, you too. Thank you so much, Cassandra.
Bye. You're very welcome. And for our listeners out there, you've been listening to The Edge, and I'm Cassandra Dane. And, of course, our guest today, William Prystock. It has been great talking with him. And don't forget, on the World of Ink Network, we've got a lot of fabulous shows coming up. On the 16th is It's Storytime with J.D. Holliday. And on the 17th, world-famous author Mitchell Byron Smith, and he's going to actually talk about dadhood just in time for Father's Day. So there's a lot coming up. Thank you so much to everyone. Have a fantastic afternoon. And in a couple of weeks, I'll have another show. I've got lots of guests coming on over the summer, so look out. They're coming your way. Thanks so much.